Ellie asked me to teach her today, and hopefully another two times. At least it's going to take two more times. While everybody else is running around the United States recruiting and visiting alumni, I was put in a bit of a something of a quandary, because I gave a similar kind of series, I guess it was last year, and I don't want to. And since this is going to go up on my Atari, I didn't want to repeat. So what we're going to do is, for the audience at home, what we're going to do is I'm going to there's new stuff here, and we're going to be repeating some of the stuff that we've got said last year as a way of segueing into a larger question, and that is, what are Rishonim and what are Achronim, and basically what do we do here? I mean, how does it all fit in together? Where did the Shitot HaLimud, where did the approaches to learning come from? That's mine. There are more, but that's mine. That's okay. You have to be very territorial in yeshiva, otherwise people will take the food you put in the refrigerator and whatever. You know, there's a joke. There's a joke about the guy who worked in a store in Tel Aviv, and he was very sort of very religious. What's the word? Very religious co-workers. So he kept bringing his lunch, and the lunch included whatever good stuff. And he would come back, and somebody had taken it, and he kept writing down his name and his telephone number and whatever. And every time he would come back, somebody had eaten his food, and finally put down Zelo Chalav Yisrael. This isn't Chalav Yisrael. Nobody touched it. So there are different ways to skin a cat. All right. In any event, what I want to do is I want to ask a bunch of questions that we generally don't ask. Like, what is Rashi doing? We learn Rashi, we learn Gemara, but we don't ask ourselves what did he do? What was before? Do you know the Rambam learned without Rashi? I mean, there are some debates whether he ever heard of Rashi at all, but the odds are he did not. If he'd heard of him or heard a few things that he had said, it certainly was not sitting there with the shots that we open up with his Rashi and his Tosfos. Then you have these 35,000-pound Gemaras that everything in the back, where you don't have to buy any others for him, but you might hurt your back carrying them. When was the Daf Gemara that we have? When was it created? Who created it? Yep. It was created first. It wasn't the first publication of the Gemara, but it was created by a man named Daniel Bomberg, who had he was a very sharp businessman, and he came up with getting the license for Hebrew printing in Venice when Jews were not allowed to print at all, in fact, in the late 15th, early 16th century. He hired a bunch of Jews, some of whom were actually converted to Christianity, some not, and put out the first shas, and he's the one that determined the Tzuras HaDaf. He's the one that, you'll excuse me if I fall back into Ashkenazis, because that's how English and Ashkenazis go together in my world. And also the Dapim, the whole question of what kind of crazy system is this? Daf Aleph Mud Beis, Daf Beis Amud Aleph, why not just, do you ever wonder, why not number the pages like a normal person? Because that's how everybody numbered pages then. Okay? About 100 years later, they'll start printing collections of Shakespeare's plays. And the earliest editions of Shakespeare are called quarto editions. Why are they called quarto editions? Because they had two pieces of paper with two columns on each side of Shakespeare's plays. So you have to refer to it as page X, column A, column B. It's not a Chinese restaurant. Column A, column B, whatever the case might be. So the Gemara, the pagination of the Gemara fits in just the way, that's how you print then. Later on, they came up with this idea of printing every single page, or numbering every single page. So that's the background of the Gemara, but that's not how it always was. I mean, originally, in fact, I had this funny situation. About 3 years ago, I was giving a lecture to a bunch of heavy-duty black hat yeshiva guys, and I mentioned that, for thousands of years, there was no text, and they were all horrified. How could that be possible? What do you mean? I'm wearing a kippah sruga. I must be not be kairos, right? So I said, why do you think it's called the Torah Shebal Peh? Because it was oral. And the Gemara says that Dvarim Shebichsav Yeta Rashai La'omram Balpeh, Dvarim Shebalpeh Yeta Rashai La'omram Bichsav. Things that are written, you're not allowed to say, you're not to recite without the book, and vice versa. Things that are oral, not written down. On the contrary, the fact that the Mishnah was written down was a violation of that halacha, requiring extraordinary action by, probably not Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, he probably just organized the material, and they invoked the term, Eis Lasos L'Shem Heferu Toratecha, that's Heferu Toratecha Mishrem Eis Lasos L'Shem, which you probably know from the Mishnah of the first for the first Perek in Brachas, but it basically means that in extreme circumstances, sometimes you have to violate the Torah in order to save it, and in this case, they did so by writing it down. That's how serious. That's like the Armageddon rule in halacha, that you violate the Torah in order to save it. And yet they invoked it in order to justify writing down the Gemara, and first the Mishnah and the Gemara, which tells you something about how deeply felt it was that the book should be oral. Okay? You can have a text which isn't written, not just on Kindle. You can have a text which is not written. All right, and that's how Torah Shebal Peh was learned. People had incredible memories, and they were able to commit long sugyas by heart. And in fact, that's not so long ago that was the case. In Yerushalayim, when my family came to Eretz Yisrael, at the turn of the previous century, it was a pretty common thing that people would walk around and they would know Gemara Rashi Tosfos by heart. In fact, I have a very dear friend who has a phenomenal memory, and when you ask him a Gemara, you see him going like this. And you can see him going page by page by page, and then he reads it to you in his memory. So it's knowing things off by heart is not that unusual. And if we divested our gray matter of a lot of the stuff that we know, imagine you didn't have to know all your passwords. And you shouldn't have just one password, right? Imagine you knew all of your usernames and all of your passwords and all this other stuff you need to know. Never mind, how to play Max Payne or whatever. I'm probably dating myself. Probably nobody plays Max Payne anymore. But you know, whatever the case might be, I'm actually an Angry Birds person. That's how I get my spilkers on. But if you got rid of all stuff, there'd be plenty of room for knowing things by heart. In any event. The Gemara was oral. That was taught. It's passed on. And even after the Gemara was organized, what do you mean organized? Around the time, around the year 500, in the school of Ravina and Ravashi, says the Gemara, and other sources, all of the discussions that are included in the Gemara were organized. Which sugya goes where? Somebody had to do this work. Think about it. Which sugya goes where? And which sugya goes to what Mishnah? And so on and so forth. It still wasn't written. In fact, deep into the 9th century, that's the 800s, at least, in Bavel, they were still insisting that everything should be known by heart. And officially, when people would study, it was known by heart. Okay? That's number one. So the fact that you have written Meforshim, the Rishonim that we desperately rely on, none of that we have them in books, but they're not written. So that's the first thing you have to keep in mind. What's interesting is that, let me ask you a question: if you open up a Gemara, any Gemara, okay, and you know enough Aramaic, I don't expect everybody to know all the Aramaic you need, but say you open it up and you read, just a sugya, all right. Would it be understandable?
No.
Okay. Even if you knew the words.
No.
Right? Why wouldn't it be understandable? What? Correct. Well, you know, that's true. You need prior knowledge, definition of terms, stuff like that. But there's even something even more basic. I mean, that which is provided to you by Rabbi Art Scroll and Rav Steinsaltz, okay, what's missing? And the word for that, it's a very basic word. What's the word? It's not punctuated, guys. You don't know where the commas are. You don't know where the question marks are. You don't know where the colons are and the semicolons. And you take a passage, okay, there are constantly, I mean, I don't have to tell you, there are constantly people that send across these really weird memes that show you that if you have the same words and you have the wrong and different punctuation, it can mean, a sentence can mean really very different things. So what does that punctuation? So you don't have punctuation, and you don't know what the terms mean, and you don't know what the connections are. So it's like a telegram. So what do you, in fact, in the Daf Yomi, what's today, Monday? In the Daf Yomi yesterday, there's a discussion of the Gemara in Yevamos, where the Gemara says, when the court goes and administers a chalitza to a woman whose husband had died and now is supposed to marry or could marry her brother-in-law, one of the things they do is recite psukim. So one of the psukim rites is a pasuk from Parshas Yibum in Dvarim, which says, Lo ava yabmi. He doesn't want to marry me. Okay? So the Gemara says, you better not hesitate and make sure that she connects the lo with the ava. Ava means rotzeh. Because if he says, Lo ava yabmi, he means, she doesn't want to marry me, so we have to do chalitza. If, however, she says, Lo ava yabmi, it means, no, he wants to marry me. So where you put the comma makes a very big difference. Okay? So just opening up a Gemara and reading doesn't get you anywhere. You need to understand. You need a tradition. You need to be able to provide all that extra information you had. So the question: who has the tickets? Who had the tickets? So the Gemara was redacted. That's a fancy word. It was added. It was put together, and there were people who knew the whole text by heart. But you needed the keys to the kingdom. You need the kings to understand it. All right? So, who had the keys? No. Where was the Gemara developed? Our Gemara. There were two. Bavel. Okay, where's Bavel? Babylonia. Thank you. You know what you remind me of? Don't take this personally. I remember when I was learning Hilchos Treifos as a kid. So my first mikra. So we're sitting there, and the Rebbe reads like this: it's a sugya in Gemara in Chulin. Amar Rav Bar Papa Loksa Bechulya Achas Treifa. Rav Ram Bar Papa said, if it was Loksa Bechulya Achas, it was Treifa. Now, how does that exactly? I mean, you know, good. That's exactly that good. I mean, that's exactly what we're talking about. Very nice. He translated the word Amar, which I think we all could have figured out by ourselves, and figured out that Rav Ram Bar Papa is in fact a person. Okay, where's Babylonia? Iraq. Babylonia, for our purposes, is primarily Iraq, especially the area of Mesopotamia, where the Mesopotamia is the two rivers between the Tigris and the Euphrates, where the Jews had been living since even before Galut Bavel. Very nice. And there were two major yeshivas. One was Sura, one was Pumbedita, and eventually they ended up moving to Baghdad because that was the big city after 750. When the Abbasid Caliphate took over, and that was the center of Jewish life. Okay, and the people who took over after the Gemara, all right, after the Amoraim of the Gemara, were known as the Heshiva. They were called Gaonim. Now, a lot of them were Gaonim, all right, but they weren't all Gaonim. The word itself is a contraction of the expression Rosh Yeshivat Gaon Yaakov, the head of the yeshiva, which is the pride, Gaon, Gaava, of Jacob. Yes? Okay, there were Savoraim. They are shadowy figures. They were the people who put the final touches on the Gemara. There were a number of that. These are the transitional figures between the Amoraim, who function inside the text, and the Gaonim, who already interpret the text. What exactly they did, what their function was, there were some that say that had a major function in making the Gemara what it looks like today, and there are others who say not. But yes, they're the transitional figures, and where the end of the Amoraim is, the beginning of the Gaonim is, and who the Svarim actually, how they figure in that, is a matter of dispute. But by the time we get to the Gaonim in the mid-century, around 750, we're definitely out of the Gaonim. Well, definitely in the world of the Gaonim. What's the difference? By the way, following this is all logically seems to go? Okay. If you have questions, please, I welcome them. What's the difference? Well, one difference is very simple. Up until the, and then we'll come back to the text. Up, but as long as you mention the Sevaroyim, I'll make this point. Up until the time of the end of the Amoraim, let's say Ravina and Ravashi, around the year 500, every single person who learned in yeshivot, whether they were big yeshivot or small yeshivot, so large batei midrash or small batei midrash, more or less participates in an ongoing symphony, what Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal used to call the symposium of the generations, not if not on an equal basis, more or less on the same playing field. In other words, the Tanaim and Amoraim have in common the fact that they are talking to each other, disagreeing with one another, and there is room for independent thought and independent ideas. In other words, an Amora is allowed, for example, to come up with an idea which perhaps a Tana didn't come up with. He can't disagree with a Tana, but he's allowed to be creative and say his own mind. Okay? Sometimes Amoraim, like Rav, early ones, are allowed to even disagree with Tanaim. But more or less, they're playing in the same playing field, and they can say something on their own. With the end of the time of the Amoraim, around with Ravashi and Ravina, maybe with the Sforoim, whatever the case might be, that changes. There's a sense that an era has ended, and now people started looking, especially once the Gemara was all organized, look at the Gemara not so much as something, a process in which I participate, but as a book or a literature. The Gemara is not a book, it's a literature on its own, which I study and which is now the constitution of the Jewish people, the constitution of the Jewish religion. If you want to compare it, if you know what you compare it to? I mean, it's not 100% accurate, but it's not inaccurate either, I think. If you think about the founding fathers of the United States, any Canadians here? Okay, please don't take this personal. Okay, I know, I have a lot of Canadian friends, and I know how touchy this can get. All right? The founding fathers of the United States, as opposed to people who live in North America. Okay, and if you ever go to, what's it called? What's the Niagara on the Lake? Right, which is where all the Tories ran away to after 1781. If you look at the founding fathers wrote the Constitution. Once the Constitution was ratified, at that point it becomes a defining document which binds all those who accept it. It's similar. I can't now go in and say, oh, so you know, stam kacha, I'm gonna rewrite the Constitution. No, now it's fixed. I'm not participating in that anymore. Okay? So something similar happens over here. Now the Gemara is accepted. How it's accepted is another story, which is for another time. But it becomes the constitution of the Jewish religion. And it stays the constitution of Jewish religion till today. In fact, I would even say that even to a significant degree, all right, even those forms of Judaism who reject the Gemara and reject the Torah Shebaal Peh as authoritative, they still have to deal with it. So that means, you know, it's still a major factor in Jewish, or if not the central factor in Jewish life. Okay, so at this point we are no longer participants, we are now interpreters of a text which we have to understand. Right? By this time, people, by and large, no longer speak Aramaic. They now speak Arabic because that's the language people speak. So now it's not just a matter of need the punctuation. I need the background material. I need the connections. I need the implications. I also need the language. All the more reason that I need to be able to have a key to the code. I need to understand what this book is. Which means that you need to be able to need to have somebody provide you with all those extra things. What's stunning is, and again, the book is that it's the only way we have to live. As the Jews told the Christians in the 13th century when they tried to burn the Gemara and succeeded, we can't live without this book because the Torah is the Chumash. Tanakh is a closed book without Chazal Chazal. Therefore, it's really striking to discover, I mean, it's stunning to discover, that there is no systematic Perush on the Gemara until the 11th century. In fact, until Rashi and his teachers, or the teachers of Rashi and Rashi. We'll get to it. Okay? There isn't. That doesn't mean that, we'll see in a little bit what Rashi does. But that doesn't mean that nobody interpreted the Gemara. But there was no systematic Perush that was promulgated. There's a good word. You guys already in college? I mean, you're already accepted, so if I tell you like good words for the SAT, it's not going to help you. Right? Okay. It's a good word anyways. There is no Perush which is promulgated like Rashi. Did people learn the Gemara? Of course they learned the Gemara. Where did they learn the Gemara? They learned it in Bavel, in yeshivas of Surim Pum Bedita. They learned it Baal Peh. People took notes. Okay, everybody takes crib notes. They took notes, but officially it was studied orally. More than that, they went through it line by line like we learned. So how come the Geonim, who were the guardians of the tradition, the heirs of the Amoraim and the Svaraim, how come they didn't write a parish like that? How come we don't have a parish like for Rabbi Gaon? He didn't write one. We have something called Otsar Geonim. Okay, I'll show an example at Dafka from, this is actually a short of high. Take a look at the bottom page one. I have one passage from a very, very valuable and important collection called Otsar Geonim, where the editor, who never actually didn't live to finish this, Binyamin Menashe Levin, went through all of Rishonic literature, this before even the Geniza was discovered, and collected all kinds of perushim of the Geonim on sugyas. Okay, I brought a sugya, a passage from something that we learned earlier in the year here from Ksubas. The question is, what happens if the father dies, the mother dies? Remember this, and what do you do with the mace? And when do you have it? When do you have shiva? When do you have shalav brachas? So the Gemara says, dafka aviv shel chasen or ima shel kala deleka inish yitrach de yitrach lehu aval ipchalo. Only the father of the chassid or the mother of the kala, because no one else is going to take care of the various parts of getting them married. But if the mother of the chassid or the father of the kala dies, you don't delay the shiva. Okay, take a look at the second paragraph. Va'amar Rav Hai, davka aviv shel chatan v'ima shel kala deleka inish de tarach lo, because no one else is going to take care of their respective issues. Aval ipchalo, why? Because generally the father, when he's marrying off a son, will be the one that makes the catering arrangements. But his father-in-law, is not going to get involved. You see, it's the exact opposite from now, right? Isn't it still true that the Kala's family pays for most of the weddings? I know it used to be true. I don't know if it's true anymore. You guys aren't married yet. I don't know. And similarly, the mother of the chassan can't deal with it either. Vegam, and he goes on in terms of preparing the kala, that the mother of the kala is the one that takes care of the wedding trousseau and the dress and the makeup and all this other stuff and so on. So he gives you an on the spot answer to explain a specific point. Okay, that's typical of Gaonic Perushim. What happened? Jews were living all over the world. The Gemara was spread throughout the world, and they would try to study, and they would write letters to Babylonia and ask the Gaon, please explain this passage, that passage. So he did. But a systematic commentary to give everyone access to understanding the Gemara independently, that they didn't write. Now, these were very valuable. The reason why we have much of this material is because when letters would come from the Gaonim, they'd go through certain basic central post offices, like in Cairo, Egypt, which was a major capital and a major center of trade. So they hear letters come from the Gaonim. So they would say, oh, good, 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 good. They would open the letters. They would copy whatever the Gaonim said and send it on. Now, that's problematic from another point of view in terms of what? You're not supposed to open other people's mail. Except that who's the one that said you're not supposed to open other people's mail? Rabbi Gershon, that's an Ashkenazi. Forget it. You think that this stuff happened? No, it's not. But it's true. The prohibition against opening other people's mail is an Ashkenazi business, which took place around the same time. But to the best of my knowledge, they didn't think about it. On the contrary, one of the reasons why Ashkenazim were not allowed to marry more than one wife is got to do with the relations between Cairo and Alexandria and Germany. It's because what would happen is Ashkenazic men would travel to the Middle East to do business, and they'd stay away for years. So boys being boys, they would raise a second family in Egypt and Syria and Baghdad and so on and so forth without telling their wives at home, which raised all kinds of interesting halachic issues. And so Rabbeinu Gershom and the Chachamim in the early part of the 11th century said, that's the end of that game. You get one wife and that's it. Yeah.
So the Karaganiza has
tons. Almost most of what we know, I think it's fair to say, most of what we know about the Gaonim comes from the Karaganiza. Okay? It's massive. It's so massive, they still haven't looked at everything that they have there. Okay? It's that massive. Although one of the neatest things, mamish, the neatest things that they've come up with recently is they're scanning all the fragments now. Because sometimes you have a piece of a book that's in Leningrad, another piece is in Los Angeles, another piece is in, and they developed a computer program where once it's all been uploaded into the computer mainframe or whatever, it's a program, can actually put together like a major puzzle, like a jigsaw puzzle, a piece from the same manuscript that might be in five different physical locations and recreate the whole page. It's like, it's awesome. Anyways, so why didn't they do it? What kind of business is this to give a book to somebody and not to give them the code? So there were actually two explanations. Take a look at the first one here. The first one is a letter from the 9th century from a person whose name is Rav Sar Shalom Gaon. He was actually very famous. He was the Gaon of Sura from 843 to 853. And he writes the following. Somebody had written him a letter and said, you know, I don't understand X, Y, and Z sugya. So he writes as follows. Sar Shalom. Okay, Sar Shalom, period. That's who's sending it. Goy shehichnis yado b'toch yeno shel Yisrael. Okay? All it's a question of stam yenam. Okay? A non-Jew touches a Jew's wine. There are tons of different ramifications and how and why and is it aser bahana, all kinds of stuff. And he says, kulan misubachot zo bezo mafilot biyoter. Okay? It's a very complicated issue. It's like, I don't think it's like, you know, a lot of professors, you'll discover, get up and they'll say, you know, it's really complicated. Now, that's usually a way of saying go away. Or I don't want to talk about it. But in this case, it really is complicated. And he doesn't know what to answer in the specific question. The im haya ratzon, if things were really right, if things were really normal, if things were proper, if we had a moment of grace, vayitim lefanenu, and you're really with us here in Baghdad. Haya efshar lefarshan yafeh yafeh. I could have sat down. I could explain all the sugyas. I'm sure you haven't learned the Avodah Zarah. It is a complicated masechta. It's really not an easy masechta. All the dinim of yei nesech and stam yeinam and under what circumstances what wine can a non-Jew touch and whatnot. And by the way, we're talking about big barrels and we're talking about Isur Hanah. It's a very, very complicated business. If you were here, we could have sat down and I could explain it to you. Efshar lefarshan yafeh yafeh ulevarah. And make sure that you understood totally. Davar dibur lo fanav, every single point by point. Mipnei kishet talmid yoshev nei rabo. V'yisav yitain b'dvar halacha. Yodea rabo leizet sadli bo note umamit alemi menu. Umamit barelo. Umamit akeshalav. Uposhet lo ad shemir einav umarelo panim bahalacha. Ava bichtav kam efshar lo ela miktsat sivinu v'katvu lachem. Says, you know, if you were here, I could see, you know, students, they sometimes understand, they don't understand, but if a teacher is a really good teacher, he can see if he understands, he can make sure help him avoid errors. But if you're on your own and you're living 3 billion miles away, what am I going to do? I'm afraid you won't understand because learning by correspondence is a real problem, has serious, serious deficiencies. And don't forget, we're not talking about just understanding a passage in Shakespeare. We're talking about something which is halacha l'maisa, and which we want to make sure people understand properly. This is Dvar Hashem. It's literally Isser v'Heter. If you don't understand properly, then you'll end up doing an Isser, and then we'll both have been sinning. On the other hand, I need to teach, so I'll do what I can, but the optimal way is to study Baal Peh. The optimal way is to study face-to-face. Okay, there's a famous, I don't know if you've ever heard of them, there's a famous, there's a famous Israeli rock group called Pugi, or Kaveret. And one of their most famous songs is about a guy who studied life-saving by correspondence. And when somebody started to drown, he jumped in also. They both ended up drowning. It's not unrelated to this point. So he says, when you give a person a parish in writing, you can misinterpret it. So it's not really empowering. It's educationally deficient. Oral study is always better. Having a tutor is always better. It's better for the teacher, and it's better for the student. So that was one reason. Apparently, they said, you know, if we write a parish, then we're just gonna mess people up because they'll misunderstand. There's a darker reason. I don't know if it's a darker reason, but well. Let's put it this way. The Gaonim were officially recognized by the Islamic government. Now listen, you have to keep in mind that up until the 15th century, the overwhelming majority of Jews in the world were what we call Sephardim or Edot HaMizrach. The Ashkenazim were a minuscule, I won't say insignificant, but certainly from a demographic point of view, they were a minuscule population. The overwhelming majority of Jews in the world lived in the Muslim world, which went from Spain, don't forget, from Spain all the way to Afghanistan and northern India and beyond. That's how the Jews actually came to China in that period, because the Jews actually spread out in order to do business and to maintain economic connections to the East and West. But that's, again, another story. For many hundreds of years, The Gaonim in Sura and Pumbedita were the official center of Judaism in the Muslim world. They were the address. Whether they were officially appointed or not, it doesn't matter. They were recognized by the community, so therefore they were it. They paskind, that's it. Finished. Okay? And everybody looked to Bavel as the center of Torah. So, in a sense, it was in their interests, because they believed that they were the only ones qualified and quantitatively able to interpret the Torah. It's not, they weren't being selfish. I mean, that's how they saw themselves. That they might not have been interested in doing so. How do I know that? Where do I come off saying that? Take a look at number two, the next text. The next text is a passage from a really very precious document that was written by a man named Rav Shrira Gaon. He lived from 906 to 1006, lived to 100 years old, which was really old then. Nobody lived that long. Rav Shrira Gaon was the father of Rav Hai Gaon, who died in 1038. In the middle of his lifetime, about 50 years before, there was a major rebellion of Muslim states in North Africa, so that contact between the western part of the Islamic Empire and the eastern part was cut, which meant the Jews who lived in Spain and Morocco and Algeria and Libya and so on couldn't communicate with Babylonia. All right? That's clear so far? So what did Jews do? What did Jews do? No? What did they do? They have to learn on their own. They have to try the best they can. Which means that they start poskening on their own. And they start interpreting on their own. Okay? We'll see in a minute how that plays out. Then the war is over and contact is restored. And the and the Gaonim write to all these communities that had been out of touch for a while, and one of the things that happened is Rav Shribir Gaon writes this letter to those communities. V'im amor tomrun bilvachem. He says, you got to start writing to us. Send us your shilas. Ask us how about Gemaras. We want to restore the connection between us and the communities. V'im amor tomrun bilvachem ki tisharun atem al matkontetchem. If you tell yourself, what do we need you guys for? We've been doing fine for the past 10 years. All right? V'lo yishachtun midrashechem v'yeshiva nishchetet. You're destroying the yeshiva. The yeshiva. Hello, Rashechem, Hema Kvod Rashechem, Rashechem Shivchem. We were established. We are the heirs of Ravir and Ravashi. We're the people you have to contact. Ve'ech yishchat rosh v'yishaleif haguf achara rosh v'arosh v'aguf holech. We are the head. We were established by the Amorayim to be the heirs of the Torah Shebaal Peh, and therefore you guys have got to. You gotta turn to us. You are the body. We are the head. If we cut off the head, what happens? The body. Gate Pfeifen, as they say in Yiddish. It's the body's not going to have a good, won't live. Okay? Hakitsuna achinu, wake up, my brethren, our brethren. V'habitu be'eila v'simu kavod l'shem elokechem l'tarato l'chachameha. Give honor to God, to Lord your God, to His Torah, and to its sages. U'luchu b'min hagavotechem, follow the custom of your ancestors, ubederech horechem, and the ways of your parents. Vachziru at the davar liyoshno. Restore the situation to what it was before. Vagidu lanos feikel techem. Ask us your questions. Tell us about your doubts. Leman tiru'un et hachuvot. So we can give you the answers. Vitkonenubam, and you vitbonenubam rather, and you'll study them. Vegam yechazak alev chachamim ayoshvim birotam ki atem bonim alehem. And also you'll encourage, you'll restore the morale of the Talmidei Chachamim sitting here in Bavel who've been out of touch, who pochadim lemizonehem, and they can't make a living. They don't know how they're going to make a living. V'yodim makom torcham, and you know how hard they study in Torah. Minat shuvot v'du'u ki lo lechvodenu, and we're not doing this for our kovid. V'lo lechvod ha'beit avinu dibanu alechem kashot kele. We're not giving you mussar to tell you that you have to talk to us and to ask us. Ki lechvod Hashem v'lechvod torato leman lo yovdun arba amoteha, so the yeshivas don't fall down. Ki afilu rabtat Torah harbe me'od b'mekomot acherim. V'ulam arba amot shel ha'alacha hineihem. This is the source of all Torah. V'zot tatzura. This are institutions. Hu b'mokom ha-Sanhedrin. And now comes the mishpat ha-machatz. V'roshah hu b'mkom Moshe Rabbeinu. What do you learn from this? Aside from the fact that the yeshiva, the Surim from Beditah, really felt that they were it. Okay. That the letters came along with donations. Okay? You don't get these anymore so much. But when I was younger, and years before, you would get Svarim in the mail, unsolicited, and they came with inside, come an envelope. And you send the check for the Sefer. All right, the Seder. The same thing over here. The yeshivas were maintained by the perushim that they gave. So in other words, there was, and again, this is not, they are totally sincere here. The Gaonim, we are the source. The Gemara came from us. We have a monopoly. But the monopoly was necessary not just because of the educational issue, but because the institution had a right to live as well. And the monopoly on perushim was maintained by the money, by the donations that came along with the questions. So those are the two reasons that the Gaonim didn't write a Perush. Okay? Nevertheless, those Perushim that we have are Perushim outside the Gemara. And again, I want to come back to this. It's very important. In other words, the Gaonim would never disagree with an Amora. They interpret the Gemara, an Amora. And that is the difference between Amoraim and Rishonim. Amoraim disagree with each other and can be original, and they can say things even without support of other Amoraim, Whereas Geonim, once the Geonim start, nothing from now on is allowed to pass muster in Halacha unless it's based on a Gemara. Okay? Hold on a second. The question then becomes, okay, so they didn't write this, and they wrote these sort of ad hoc perushim here and there and everywhere. Okay, which, it, you know, the Sach HaKol is very large, but nevertheless, that's what they do. So Rishonim, so the definition of a Rishon, and we'll talk about what happens immediately afterwards, the definition again of a Rishon is a person who addresses the Gemara from the outside to make it accessible, but does not participate in the dialogue of the Amorayim and the Tanayim and the Prushim and the Sofrim and whatever. Yes, who was the good question? Yes.
Should we infer that there were certain authorities that were appointed over, like the provinces in the west, that was, you know, had a hard time communicating with the east for a while because Rav Shargarod is writing in Hebrew, which to most Jews living, well, most people in the world, you normally write in the vernacular, but this is something that clearly is writing Hebrew. You have to have an authority. You have to have a big rabbi.
So now I'm going to actually bust a balloon, or slaughter a sacred cow. It is true that Eliezer ben Yehuda, whose 175th yahrzeit, our birthday, was recently marked in Israel, did in fact make Hebrew into a living modern language. It doesn't mean it was a dead language. Hebrew was the lingua franca, that's a funny way to say it, but Hebrew was the lingua franca of Hebrew and rabbinic Hebrew. What's rabbinic Hebrew? Rabbinic Hebrew is Hebrew with a bunch of Gemaras and Aramaic and stuff like that. Was understood by anyone who was literate, read Hebrew. The degree, I'm not saying everybody was totally literate, but everybody knew how to read, every men certainly, and many of women knew how to read Hebrew. There was the degree of broad Hebrew literacy was extensive, and Hebrew functioned not rarely as a spoken language as well. Forever. It was always like that. Up until down, okay, in Eastern Europe in the 16th century, the degree to which people actually could speak Hebrew was relatively low in the 16th, 17th century, but as a literary language that people wrote to each other, always. You didn't have to be a big rabbi to be able to read Hebrew. On the contrary, a lot of the material in the Geniza are letters that are written by, whether it's good Hebrew or bad Hebrew, but they write in Hebrew. They write in Hebrew and they write in Arabic. But if you're writing to somebody in a different area, just one second, in a different area, indeed, they write in Hebrew. I told you that there was Jewish merchants who would come to, and they would set up shop in Alexandria, wherever. A lot of the international trade was in the hands of Jews. And we know for a fact that what happens when a Jew from France, okay, ends up going into business or having an exchange with a Jew from, I don't know, from Iraq or from Babel, all right? And they end up in Samarkand, which is in Tashkent, and they have a Din Torah. So what language do they speak in? They speak in some sort of improvised Hebrew, because you know enough Hebrew to be able to improvise based on Psukim. I saw it myself as a kid. People talking to each other in Hebrew. It's, you know, va'omarila, va'yehilo. I mean, it's not the way we would speak, but it was sufficiently strong to be able to function that way. Never mind the fact that that later on in Spain, I mean, you talk about the explosion of the Hebrew language. But people are writing in Hebrew, and it's not just big rabbis. The fact that American Jewry is fundamentally Hebraically illiterate is, including many in the Orthodox community, I am sorry to say, is actually it's the exception more than the rule. Okay, it's true they were learned people in the West, they were learned people in the East, there were maybe more learned people in the East than in the West. That's true, and there were different gradations, but it would be wrong to think that the situation that it obtained in Spain and North Africa was the same as obtained, say, in Chicago, or say I'm not giving any places in Chicago, Nashville or Utah or whatever the case might be. You had a question, okay, all right, okay, we actually got off the first page. Interestingly. And I can't, I really have no, I can't explain, I don't know how to explain why this is. Rav Shrira Gaon's, Rav Shrira Gaon's request was not honored. With the death of Rav Hai Gaon, In 1038, we generally say that the last of the great Gaonim is over, and all the action moves west. And it's interesting, right after Rav Hai Gaon dies, actually a little bit before that, okay? In three separate places, I'm talking about two separate places, in the Western world, one in the Islamic orbit and one in the Christian orbit, Jews, scholars sit down and start writing independent Perushim on the Gemara. One place is the city of Kairouan in North Africa, which was like New York City at the time. Okay, although a lot of good stuff's happening in Spain too, but it's interesting that Kairouan is where it starts. And the other place is in Magenza, in Mainz, Germany. Four people who I need to mention in this regard. One is Rabbeinu Nisim Gaon, who was not a Gaon. He was a Gaon. He was not a Gaon. Right? In other words, he's a Kairouan. He was in Babylonia, but he's a Gaon, is one person. Another one is his contemporary, Rabbeinu Hananel. The third one is Rabbeinu Gershom Moragola in Mainz. And the fourth one is Rashi. All of them in their own way, and we're going to talk about what each one of them does, because that's going to be important for the continuity, sit down and say, you know, we really need to write down a parish on the Gemara so people can study. Okay, now, keep in mind something. What was it, one of the things I mentioned, that's a revolution. Because by writing a parish to the Gemara, I mentioned this before, by writing a parish to the Gemara, you're doing a few things. Number one, you're making it accessible. By making it accessible, what does that give you? Knowledge is power. By virtue of the fact that you're writing a parish on the Gemara, you're basically making it accessible, and as a result, you're saying to the Gaonim, yeah, we can function on our with all due respect, we can function on our own. So that's a dual thing. By the way, this whole idea of empowering somebody by making the Gemara accessible to them is a contemporary moment too. All right, and I'll give you an example which I think is accurate. I was told this by more than one person, but I'm not going to swear to it that's 100%. But if the fact that the story could be told says something as well. In the 1980s, as before any of you were born, I think, right? In the 1980s, I don't know, there was a huge argument, a real polemic between Rav Steinsaltz and major figures in the Haredi world, especially in Punovich and Slobodka, but Punovich especially. And it ended up developing such that at some stage, Rav Steinsaltz was actually put in Cherem. What did he do, so gefährlich? So there were two things that there was one thing that he said, which I think was not the real reason, and what was the other reason? The reason that they gave was the fact that in a book that Rav Steinsaltz wrote about Tanakh, about heroes of Tanakh, he said basically that he called Shimshon a biryon, sort of a bully, or sort of a rough, Johnny Bravo type, type of person. Okay? And that was terrible to talk about Shimshon that way. Truth of the matter is, Chazal themselves were sort of like conflicted about Shimshon. And I'm never quite sure whether like your parents, how many of you have sisters? Like, I'm not so sure like if your parents would be happy if your sister brought home Shimshon. Like, you know, hey dad, this is what I brought home. Well, not so positive. But all right, maybe yeah, maybe no. Everybody has a different, everybody has taste. Different tastes. In any event, that was one thing that they attacked me for. But I think that was whatever. The deeper reason, the way it was explained to me, was the fact that there was tremendous objection to the Steinsaltz Gemara. What were the objections? There were a number of different objections. One objection is the fact that there's realia there, that there's all kinds of like semi, you know, scholarly stuff there. Another objection was the fact that if you have a punctuated Gemara, the people won't learn how to learn, they'll get lazy, they won't know how to crack a Gemara on their own, which is, you know, educationally correct. And thirdly, and this was the interesting part, there was a fear of putting the Gemara in the hands of non-religious people. Because the Steinsaltz Gemara was originally created in order to be able to serve as a cultural bridge between the Orthodox community and the non-Orthodox community in Israel. And there was objection to that. Certainly, if you even if in the Orthodox community, if you make everybody it makes everything accessible, then that raises questions of, you know, who has a right to an opinion. Anava is the Rav always used to say Anava is an integral part of Talmud Torah. No arrogant person can ever be a big Talmud Chacham, only an Anav. However, Anava is only infused when you learn in a certain specific atmosphere. Right, so there was a fear that maybe that was also, and in fact, there is a problem here too. If you empower, that's what Rav Shri Bar Gaon was also nervous about. Okay. Nevertheless, Rabbeinu Chananel, Rabbeinu Gershom Mor Hagolah, and Rashi did undertake to interpret the Gemara. However, again, how you interpret a book is going to tell you about how your attitude is towards that book and what you're supposed to get out of it. We'll take each one. I have three examples, okay? The first one is from Rav Nissim Gaon's Perush on the Gemara. It's printed. By the way, these Perushim did not really make it. It's interesting. Rabbeinu Chananel, it appears on some of our printed Chassin, but you should know that he was known secondhand from other people quoting his opinions until relatively recently. It was sort of like his Perush sort of disappeared because people were so taken with Rashi. And the same thing with Rabbeinu Nissim. But let's see how they go about what is the nature of learning Gemara according to each one of these early Rishonim. Okay, it's a Mishnah in the beginning of in the first parak in Brachas. It's a Mishnah we all know because of the Haggadah Shel Pesach. Maskir and Yitzias Mitzrayim Balelos. You suppose a mitzvah of Haskosi Yitzmayim at light. Amar Ablozer Abizaya Harei Kiven Shivim Shana Velo Zachisi Chteyamir Yitzias Mitzrayim Balelos Achid Rasha Ben Zoma Shenema Lemant Tiskod Yom Tiskam Eretz Mitzrayim Kol Yemechayecha Yemechayecha Yamim Kol Yemechayecha Leilos. The call is interprets, it adds an extra time frame. Very nice. Okay. What does Rav Nissim Gaon say on this? Zeshe Shaninu. Amar Rav Elazar ben Azariah. Harei ani kiven shivin shana. Mifrisha milte bet perek tfilat hashachar. We understand what he says based on something in a later perek in, was it the third perek? Third perek, no, hold on. Fourth parak in Brachas. B'maaseh shahaya beid Rabban Gamliel v'Reb Yoshua be'et sheskimu chachamim la'avir Rabban Gamliel migdulato u'lamlich tachtav et Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah amar v'hu bartman yisare and so on and so forth. How do we know Ben Shivim? What did he feel had to be interpreted? How is it that he's 70 years old? He says, no, we know that he really wasn't 70 years old. Why say Kiven Shivim Shana? Because overnight he turned white and he looked like he was 70, and therefore when they rebelled against Rav Gamliel and they overthrew Rav Gamliel, they made Rav Elazar ben Azariah the Nasi for a period of time, so he looked like he was 70 years old. That's what he felt he had to explain. What is that? In terms of a commentary, Rabbeinu Nissim is very similar to the Gaonim. He picks specific issues, gives you a little essay, and that's it. By the way, you don't need the Gemara. You could actually pick up the parish of, it's called something else, I don't want to go into the names of the books, but you could just pick it up and read it. It's like reading the Meiri. You could pick up the Meiri and not read the Gemara. It's like Monarch Notes. You still use Monarch Notes and Cliff Notes? I don't even know what that is. Okay. I'm old. Cliff Notes. Okay. It's like Cliff Notes on the Gemara. And believe me, everybody knew it. As soon as they started publishing, oh boy, here we go. Now we're all set. Now we just have to figure out who's talking about, because he doesn't tell you who's who. He's got all these fancy names, Gudolei this and Chashuvei that and Kol HaMeforshim and so on and so forth. Okay. So Rabbeinu Nissim is writing you summaries. That's it. That's exactly what Rabbeinu Chananel does. In both cases, neither of them go into the line by line kind of interpretation. Okay? Why? You're supposed to be interpreting the Gemara. I would like to suggest that because this, they reflect, and this is true in terms of other early Sephardic Rishonim as well, that there is a fundamental difference between Sephardic, next time, I hope. There's a fundamental difference between Sephardic and Ashkenazic ideas of classical Sephardic, what the function of learning Gemara is. The Sephardim, and this is all the way down to Rav Avad Yosef, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, the function of learning Gemara is Lasuke Shmaitza Aliba the Hilchasa. I want to know the bottom line. I learned Gemara to know the Halacha. Goodbye. Finished. That's it. So if that's the case, so if you sum up things and you have enough information to get to the bottom line, that's enough. And that's what you find in Rabbeinu Nissim, and that's what you find in Rabbeinu Hananel. Summaries, he'll bring you the Yerushalmi Rabbeinu Hananel, but in general, he'll zoom in on the key points, give you what you need. But it's interesting, the line-by-line kind of thing that Rashi provides, and then Rabbi Artscroll provides, Rabbi Steinfeld provides, is not, by the way, somebody once offered, and we'll talk about this next time, we'll talk about Rashi and Tosfos, somebody once offered that, you know, now it's sort of Artscroll has taken over for, and all the knockoffs, has taken over for Rashi, but if you take a look at if you compare Rashi to what gets written in between the words in the Gemara in bold and the Artscroll Gemaras, I mean, you've opened Artscroll Gemaras, right? All right, you'll see it's just a knockoff of Rashi. I mean, just you put take Rashi from over here and put over there. Yes, what was the question?
When did the Sephardi scholarship begin? Like, if you say, so if it started like this in this time, you know, the period of like the late Gaon, early Gaon,
mm-hmm.
then fine. But what didn't it, wouldn't it have started much, much earlier?
Okay.
And so why was the Gemara created in this way?
All right. So, why the Gemara is written in this place is a question that I can't answer. Maybe other people can. This is what the Amorayim in their wisdom decided to do. And the truth of the matter is, when you think about it, the genius is incredible, because it's not just a matter of from a religious point of view. You have to be a Melim Batara, which by itself is a virtue, but more than that, the fact that it's written this way allows for multiple interpretations of the Gemara itself. Because you can, I mean, Rashi and Tosfos can have a Mahalach in the Gemara. All right. You know each one shita, then you have to work it through the Gemara, but you see that the words actually do support more than one interpretation. In fact, they say that in Baranovich, Rav Elchanan Zatzal, Hashem Yikom Damo more appropriately, I never checked it with somebody who learned in Baranovich. I mean, my wife had an uncle in Baranovich, but he didn't survive the war. That he would say, learn Gemara Rashi, and then think about all the logical alternatives to what Rashi says. And if you come out of that and work it through the words, then you'll come up with every single Shitas Rishonim. So, you know, but that's what it worked out, okay? In terms of when does Torah come to Spain, which is the question I hear you say, the Gemara apparently first comes to Spain around the year 800, early in the Gaonic period. But and in fact, many of the most important shilas that we can identify that come to Babel actually come from Spain. When does independent Spanish Torah learnings come? It's generally associated with the arrival of a person whose name was Rabbeinu Moshe, Rabbeinu Chanoch, who comes to Spain as a captive and is redeemed according to the story. However the story is, he does arrive in Spain. He is sponsored by the leading head of the Jewish community, who is also the senior minister in the Spanish caliphate, whose name is Chazda ibn Shaprut, Abu Yusuf Chazda ibn Shaprut, and he starts the yeshiva. And that's really when an independent Torah scholarship starts. Around exactly the same time as this break in communication with Babel. So the two are more or less coterminous. Interestingly, that's precisely the time when Torah study apparently starts in Ashkenaz as well, even though we're part of a different world. So exactly, Mamish is exactly the same time, because the Rebbe of Rabbeinu Gershom, whose name was Rabbeinu Leontien, is French, and he's also... We date him also around 950, something like that. So the time that the Western centers, Spain and France and Germany, begin to take off is precisely the exact same time. Prior to that, they're studying, no question, but they're certainly in the Muslim world, in the Islamic world, they're writing, they're doing the best they can, and they're writing to and they're writing to Bavel for around 950, 960, something like that. That's when everything moves west. And Bavel starts going into decline. In fact, one of the things that the Rambam fights against, the Gaonim and Bavel, the heirs of the Gaonim and Bavel are constantly trying to reassert their prerogatives. And the Rambam is less than impressed with these people in Babylonia. So in fact, if you take a look, if you want to take a look, in the if you look in the Hakdama of the Rambam, the Mishneh Torah, so on the on the third page, he writes about the Shalshalat HaMasoret from Moshe Rabbeinu to Ravashi. He does it three times. It's interesting. Moshe Rabbeinu to Ravashi, Ravashi to Moshe Rabbeinu, and then Moshe Rabbeinu to Ravashi again, just to emphasize the importance of Shalshalat HaMasoret, because he's fighting against the Karaites, among other things. Then he goes on and says, but after Chasimus HaGemara, so everything becomes sort of decentralized. And he says, "V'kol achachamim in Spain and France and this and that and North Africa, all of them are called Gaonim." What's the point? The point is that there's nothing specifically unique about the Gaonim in terms of their authority. We our point of departure. Our point of departure is the Gemara. One, in fact, and then this will close. In fact, who has the right to interpret, and this whole thing, as you saw that there were two issues I've been talking about, really. One is the question of who has the right to an opinion, where are the centers, who's the authority, and B, who's going to interpret the Gemara. The two go hand in hand. There is a major machlokas rishonim over the question of, do the Gaonim have special status in Psak? So machlokas, the Balamor, and the Ravid, and the Ravid, and all kinds of major rishonim. The Gaonim are sort of like, they're like... you know, they're like the Apple 6OS, you know, like the Apple 6S. We have to 6S yet? No. Apple 6. You know, but they're sort of like, they're like first among equals. It ultimately really comes down to the question, to the following question. Do you look at a person by virtue of his personal status or by what they do? If it's personal status, you can say, yeah, the Gaonim are the heirs of the traditions of Abai and Rava, therefore they should be deferred to as much as possible. The Rambam and other Rishonim would say, no, what do the Gaonim do? The Gaonim basically, like us, accept the Gemara from the outside, we interpret it, we try our best to understand it, to mine its secrets and apply its rules to contemporary circumstances. So from the point of view of commentary, we do the same as they do. We approach the Gemara, unmediate it, and interpret it. So based on that, the Gaonim ask, we do the same thing. So that's the case. So, you know, we will give deference, give cover to Torah, but in terms of blind obedience, no. In a certain sense, that's the machlokas. If you want to take a look at the at a discussion, you can take a look in the Rush, has a famous Rush in Sanhedrin, Perek Dalet, Siv Dalet, Simon Dalet, rather, where he has a long, long discussion on this on specifically this issue. All right, so what we will do, so we actually got a lot done. So next time, I don't know when that's going to be, that's up to Ellie and Rabbi Tarrigan to figure out. Next time we'll talk about Rashi and Tosfos and the Ramban. I want to talk about the Ashkenaz Rishonim to see what they do, which is going to be very different than what we've discussed up so far. And then in the third session, we will talk about what are Acharonim. What's the difference between us and them, and how did that end up being the conceptual method of Torah analysis that we cultivate in this yeshiva? Okay.